Hello and welcome to episode 180 of the Big Picture Podcast. I'm your host, Bidemi Olugunde. So on this episode 180, I was interviewed by my distinguished mentor and friend, Peter Galanis, who was my august guest on episode 178. So it was actually his suggestion for us to do a 180 degree turnaround and change for episode 180, so that instead of me interviewing a guest, then a guest would interview me, and then I offered for that to be him. So here we are. So the conversation touched on how I transitioned from graduate degrees in electrical engineering to the cybersecurity industry, how and why I decided to go for a career in information security, what drives me to be passionate about cybersecurity and cyber threat intelligence and intelligence analysis, some of my insights on the threat landscape, the self-driving cybercrime ecosystem, software supply chain attacks, initial access brokers, the downsides to companies like Patreon downsizing or outsourcing their security teams, my thoughts on a hypothetical scenario about smart contracts and how they could hinder small businesses that are just trying to stay profitable, as well as other topics such as Russia, Ukraine, cryptocurrency, and much more. Finally, we wrapped up the conversation with some of my advice for people coming up through the ranks or thinking about entering the cybersecurity field. So details on how to get in touch with me are in the show notes. And without further ado, here is Peter Galanis' conversation with me, Bidemi Olugunde. So thanks once again for joining us. I'm back here with my August guest in September. And this episode, we're doing something new, which is actually Mr. Galanis' idea. He said for episode 180, we should do a 180. So he's going to be interviewing me on this episode of the Big Picture Podcast. So over to you, sir.
Thank you, Ben. So a couple of things. First off, thanks for having me back so soon, especially after rambling so much the last time. I promise. Today is a different sort of big picture. This one is about you. This is, to your point, this is that 180. This is looking back on BID. You've had 179 previous podcasts and all sorts of wonderful guests, and you've had some good interaction, but nobody's actually turned the tables on you yet and actually asked some of the basic questions, some of the hard questions, some of your thoughts, and what's driving you and what's steering this. So I want to thank you for having me here and allowing me to do this. It's exciting. Matter of fact, I find this actually more exciting than the one with me, because I'm going to get to hear all your answers. So for all of your listeners out there, just to let you know, just to kind of reiterate, this is a 180. This is episode 180. This is a 180. This is a look back on BID and really getting to understand what drives BID. How did he get into this? What are some of his insights on cybersecurity and just other things in general? What's happening in, you know, Russia and the Ukraine? What's happening with crypto? What's happening in all sorts of different areas? So with that, then I'm going to start off in a way that you do on many of yours. And I want you to take a moment, introduce yourself, and then tell us what you do.
Thank you very much, sir. And it's actually my pleasure to have you do this, to basically get me to dive deep into my motivations, my origin story, my backstory, my whatever story, and actually present myself as a candidate on my own podcast, which is a nice way to look at things from a different perspective, which is something I enjoy getting from you. Every interaction we've had, the calls, the video calls, the text messages, and so on. So it's my pleasure to have you doing this for me. Thank you once again, sir. So to jump into the question, to briefly introduce myself, my name is Bidemi Olugunde. I also go by BID. Came into the US in 2012. For grad school, that was December 2012. So grad school was supposed to be master's, PhD in electrical engineering, which I was able to complete. And then from there, I was able to get into the corporate world. And a brief summary from grad school into my corporate experience is my grad school degree was in electrical engineering. And electrical engineering, for those that don't know, has so many components. There is signals and systems. There is wireless network security. There is the actual power systems. Think about electricity, power generation, transmission, distribution, and so on. So there are elements of electrical engineering that overlap with computer science, computer engineering, and so on and so forth. So my own section of electrical engineering was wireless network security, which, as most people can tell by now, overlaps a whole lot with computer science and computer engineering and so on. So that is my bridge, so to speak, into cybersecurity, because my theses and dissertations were looking into how I can secure a wireless communication channel from one host device to the server. The communication goes through wires and cables, and then somewhere inside that network, it jumps into the air, literally, to the receiver, and then the old decoding process happens. So studying how that channel can be secure was my niche, basically. And from there, I was able to see that, okay, I can actually learn more about networking and Cisco routers and CCNA certifications and CCNP. And then from there, it was a very quick step to A plus, Security plus, Network plus, and so on and so forth. So that was kind of my own route. So it started from an academic point of view. And then from there, I was able to see that, okay, getting all these fancy degrees, master's and PhD, is fine. But then to actually do hands-on stuff, I need to be able to learn like the people who are in that field learn. So of course, my academic background helped, but of course, there's no 100% view of cybersecurity from adjacent domains. So I can have the academic background and all that, but I still needed to be an analyst from the network side. I needed to be an analyst from the alerts triage side and so on. So that exposed me into cybersecurity from a corporate technical background. And then I worked for a financial company briefly. From there, I got to Verizon 2017. I was in Verizon for about 3-4 years. And that's how I met you. And yeah, so along the line, it's been a whole lot of learning, which is something I'm always proud to tell anyone. So with the graduate school degrees, learning doesn't stop. I would actually say it helped me know where to start again from. So getting Security Plus is like entry level requirement now. But I got my Security Plus as someone with advanced academic degrees in computer science, computer engineering, wireless network security, and so on. So that's kind of a brief summary of my journey into cybersecurity, what drives me. That, and I guess that shows in my approach even up till now. If I'm approaching any kind of investigation, I'm thinking as a scientist. That academic background shows all the time. I'm asking what happened. I'm asking how did it happen? Why did it happen? Where did it first happen? If it first happened somewhere, or if we're first seeing it in our organization, and then how will this impact us? After answering all those questions or attempting to answer all those questions, the next thing is to now present that information as concisely as possible to the people that need to know it. Is it my incident response guys? Is it my threat intelligence guys? Is it the vulnerability management team? Is it someone like you back then at Verizon, the executive director, and the people that the executive director report to, or the people who report to the executive director? So that's kind of my brief summary of my journey into cybersecurity.
So a couple things out of that. So one, I did not know that. So I learned something new every time as well. And I love that. I've heard you on a couple of your podcasts, and you've asked a couple of questions. I'm going to frame in two or three questions in this one area, and then I'm going to let you go. The first is you've talked before about hands-on experience and formal education and kind of the mix between the two and how that sets you up. And you've actually brought this up a few times. And you've had responses to other people's response, but never your own fully articulated. And I'd love to hear that on how those play together based on what you've said before. The other thing is, you talked about the complexity. You talked about taking a scientific approach when you start looking at this. And this is going to be a multi-part. I'm going to ask for a couple of things here. So the first part is, electrical engineering is engineering. I mean, there's obviously scientific background behind it, same as with computer science. The question is, though, what I didn't hear is, what drives you in the cybersecurity aspect? What really got you interested? If it's just the intellectual component, there's a highly sophisticated intellectual component within the wireless component of electric engineering that you mentioned. So there's more behind that, and I'm curious what that is. I think I know some of it, but I want to hear it from you. Then the other aspect is that you talk about a purely scientific approach, but what are your thoughts on, as you start talking about people and the motivations behind it and the drivers and the unique things that you see that are not necessarily scientific? You have to kind of pull, there may be a scientific approach, but you have to start pulling some threads and getting to a point where now you have to understand the adversary's thought process, which is different than a pure scientific approach. So start with the education piece, get into what's driving you with cyber, and then I want to hear you kind of turn that a little bit and talk about the other, because I'm really, really curious about this one.
Got it. Thank you very much, sir. So to address the first part of the question, so what drives me in the cybersecurity domain of my journey, of my career, and so on. Like I said, all of this started from my experience from an educational academic background, and I guess jumping into the industry, jumping into the field itself, I started to realize how, as with most things in life, there are two sides to anything. There's one coin. One side says an academic approach to cybersecurity. On the other side of that coin is the social scientific approach, if I can use that word, is the non-academic approach. It's the angle where nothing is black and white, because on one side, I can say a hacker goes into his network for one or two reasons, either for financial reasons or for espionage. That's the academic angle. Maybe I want to prove or disprove that statement. Then I look for evidence to support either side of that argument. On the other side of that coin, which I am alluding to, is that the social scientific approach, there's that human factor saying a threat actor, a hacker, a cyber criminal does something for so many reasons. It could be personal. It could be they are bored on a weekend. It could be someone is paying them, someone in uniform is paying that threat actor to get into a network and steal secrets. It could be for financial purposes. It could be because his partner got angry or mad for whatever reason and is trying to do something to win his or her partner back. So many different reasons. And it's just getting me personally to see that there are multiple ways to approach anything. So that innate curiosity I have that didn't let me sit and just be comfortable in that academic field of cybersecurity, because there are so many career paths that someone with a PhD in electrical engineering can go within the cybersecurity industry. Mm-hmm. We see them every day in the news talking about something that the CISA, the DHS does. It could be a position within an organization that would allow them to just be consultants, someone that just writes white papers all day. But I wasn't comfortable enough to just be in that bucket, just look at things from a purely academic angle, I guess I can say I haven't lost my curiosity. Regardless of where I find myself, even if I'm learning how to coach basketball, if I'm learning how to be a good cybersecurity analyst, I want to be able to see both sides of that coin. So that is some of the things that drive me in basically anything I do. So I approach cybersecurity from an academic point of view, but I'm conversant enough with the field to know that it's not all about the black and white prove or disprove why a hacker is doing something. It goes way beyond that. Some of the questions I've come across so far in my career, 10 plus years, some questions don't have answers. And I've learned to realize that that is also fine. I can now write a report that says, we are seeing this thing is happening regarding some threat actors. We don't know why it's happening. And that is a perfectly okay report to send up and down the flagpole. So that's one, I guess I'm able to answer that first part of what drives me in the cybersecurity field itself. So regarding my thoughts on the people side of things versus the scientific approach, I would say to touch on how I answered the first part of the question, people are not necessarily simple human beings, or there's no easy answer to why people do what they do. And in line with that, threat actors, who are basically the people I literally study them to provide good intelligence, I'm always curious to find out that, for example, some countries that have established threat actor programs, you find out that individuals in one group do something to focus on maybe hacking a particular country on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then on Thursday, Friday, the same individuals literally switch something on their network or device or move into a different room and then do a different set of attacks, focusing on a different country, on the different part of the world. So when the academic mind would say that APT, let's say APT 99, attacks a European country, and then someone else could now say that we see that APT 97 attacks an African country. However, APT 97 and APT 99 are literally three guys working on the same computer, but on different days of the week, they're focusing on this country, and then we categorize them as APT 97. And then on 2 days of the week, they're focusing on a different country entirely. And then we categorize them as APT 99. But they're literally three same guys working in the same basement, in the same Ministry of Defense, for the same government. Things like that get me thinking about how I can get to the root of all of that and just avoid that black and white labeling of threat actors that do this, they have this name. And threat actors that do this other thing, they have this other name. So that's just one example of why I think that scientific approaches are nice, but then there's also that non-scientific human element that we also have to consider.
I've been writing down some questions as you've been talking. First is a comment, and that is on your what I think is a very astute response on you don't know why somebody did something or you don't have the answer. I will tell you, as an executive in this field, having that clearly defined at a point in time, right? Because it's always a point in time. You may 15 minutes later, an hour later, 2 weeks later, whatever the time, you might have the answer to some of those things that you don't know. But by clearly stating what you know and what you don't know and putting it into just empirical facts makes it that much easier to read and disseminate that report, because now I don't have to come back with questions and go, yeah, but what about this? Instead, it clearly states that we don't know it at this time. Okay. And then there may be, and we are working on this, this, and this to find that data, and that's great. So I completely agree with you. Not knowing something is fine.
Right.
at a point in time.
Right.
There's, you know, and it depends on how early it is. It depends on the information you have, your partnerships, the size of the company, et cetera. So I think that was a very astute point. So
thank you, sir.
Good call out there. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, you went down a slightly different path. You didn't really answer, and I'm going to hold you accountable for this. You didn't really answer the question as to why cybersecurity and not electrical engineering. You hit on some of the components. But what is it about cybersecurity that drives you? That first off got you so interested? Yeah, hands on. Okay, great. You know what? Could have had hands on doing wireless networking and looking at the security in, you know, a Wi-Fi 6 environment, as that was, you know, just a couple of years ago it was burgeoning, right? You know, or, you know, looking at, you know, 5G, but that's not the route you went. Mm-hmm. And you could have, and it would have been just as interesting. So my question is, there's some sort of tugging component. What is it? What got you hooked on security and cybersecurity especially?
Right. Thank you for that, sir. So shortly before I left Nigeria in 2012, I actually applied to so many schools, not just within the US, but also in Ghana, South Africa, the United Kingdom, and so on, because my parents are of the opinion that something that is worth doing well. And they made sure to give every single one of us, me and my four siblings, equal opportunity, equal access, and so on, which is something I'm mirroring for my own son and future children later on. So that being said, I also applied to so many different schools. I actually applied to, I would say, 6 schools in the US, but the University of South Florida was the first to actually accept me. So that's where I ended up. I also applied to Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Ghana. And I actually got accepted, and I was there for about 3 months. And I would say that's where I started to realize that not everything about electrical engineering or computer science or chemical engineering or whatever engineering or whatever field, there are so many layers. Take, for example, architecture. There's architecture. My cousin is actually an architecture PhD student, so I know quite a bit about that. There is the aspect of architecture that talks about structures and bridges. There's aspect of architecture that talks about how water affects buildings. So they study water. There are aspects of architecture that talks about just types of soil and how they impact buildings. So knowing that, okay, electrical engineering is vast, there's actually overlaps between electrical engineering and computer science. Those are the two closest cousins, like I always call them. And then in Ghana, I was actually able to see how the Ghanaian government started to develop interest among high school kids on everything computer. And that was happening around that time on the campus of that university where I actually was supposed to have my graduate degree. And I paid attention, I would say, and I started to realize these kids took the same route I took in high school, but they would get into university and not go the electrical engineering way or the computer science and engineering way. They would go a totally different route and just focus on what the computer can do, what the computer can be made to do, both offensively and defensively, and actually be doing cool stuff. And because, like I mentioned earlier, I'm the kind of person, I'm innately curious. I would drive down the road, see a particular street light and how it's different from another street light in terms of height and shape and so on. And I would start thinking, why is that? And then I get home and I'm on Google typing, looking up different types of streetlights and why they make them differently. So all those types of curiosities got me wondering if there's a different route to take and not end up as an academic with letters after your name, and you can actually do stuff with computers and go into a computer. And I was able to know that, okay, there was something called freaking that happened back then. And I was like, is this similar to freaking? And you can do stuff and tap the phone without actually dialing the numbers, and you can actually make calls that way. And it got me curious. And shortly after that, I came to the US and I was reading books in the library that had nothing to do with electrical engineering. So that led me from sometime in 2011, that led me curious into seeing that, okay, there are things that can be done on a computer that can make you do good things and do bad things and figure out how to access information that you shouldn't necessarily have access to, but for good purposes, and prevent someone else from doing that to your own networks, and so on and so forth. So that led me, that curiosity led me down that path, and I would say here I am today. So
so if I kind of paraphrase it, based on knowing you, I'm gonna put it a little bit differently. There's a unique challenge to cybersecurity that you took on that was not just the pure scientific method. Right. You could have done that. You could have done that with the others. And by the way, you could still be working with a computer with the others. What seems, and through our previous conversations, what drives you is the diversity of the challenges that consistently come up. Once you solve it, it changes.
Yep, correct.
So, you know, you also made another comment earlier. Now that we've gotten that done, and thank you, by the way, that's always great information. So the other thing you were talking about was the APT, you know, convergence and the fact that, you know, there are three guys in a ministry building down in the basement, you know, APT 97 one day, and, you know, they're going to pivot, and they're going to have another target, another acquisition component, and another. So that's an interesting point. Tell me what your thoughts are, because, you know, we talked about this a couple of days ago, or a week or so ago, in the fact that between the impact, the cost, and the theft within cyber crime, cyber impact, and just cyber components is 6.7 trillion, I believe, is the number that I last read. So part of that is because of the developing ecosystem, the economic ecosystem that is hugely profitable on the criminal side and the criminal activity. Talk to me a little bit about that, and you know, you were talking earlier about motivations, and, you know, potentially two motivations, and there are probably more, but the two that you mentioned were you know, either, you know, financially motivated or data motivation, and by the way, the reason why I didn't put, you know, I didn't say which kind of espionage, because you know, it's about data. It's whether, you know, is it corporate espionage, is it, you know, governmental espionage? It could be any number of things, but it's a data piece, right? So talk to me a little bit about what you've uncovered and your thoughts on the cyber economy. You know, they say that there's no honor amongst thieves, but I would also say that the converse is true too. If you're dealing with thieves, you have to be a little bit more, you know, careful, which means that people are a little bit more strict on certain things. So talk to me a little bit about your thoughts on that and how it's growing and where you see it going in the next couple of years, considering that it is such a profitable area.
So my thoughts on data thefts in general?
No, cyber crime in general and the impact of it, but more importantly, the ecosystem, the self-deriving ecosystem. You know, we've talked about this before where you can get on the dark web and you could actually, you know, pay for a DDoS attack. You could purchase, you know, a you know, piece of ransomware. You could there are elements that are now commodities, paid for commodities, using, you know, fractional Bitcoin. And the question really is where do you see this going?
Right. Thank you, sir. So, the cybercrime ecosystem, in my opinion, would only keep expanding. And I say that because 5, 10, 15 years ago, the major forms of cybercrime were kind of limited in scope to credit card theft and someone impersonating someone else, steal money, and the very beginnings of business email compromise. And now it's moving into the crypto domain, and it's moving into SIM swaps, and SIM swaps can be used to then conduct further different types of attacks and all sorts of HIPAA violations, privacy violations, simply because everything is now networked together. So that's why we see attacks like the Twilio attack, for example, and everything it touches. And up until now, September 13, we still don't know who was impacted by the Twilio attack. And that just shows how connected everything is to everything else. So the cybercrime ecosystem, I would say, as much as the defenders are having sleepless nights on how to defend and protect, and we touched on that on your episode, episode 178, and how organizations need to start thinking about securing their data in transit and securing their data at rest and everything that comes with that, I would say the attackers are also having sleepless nights, because now they are trying to figure out what dependencies can they exploit, the vulnerabilities within software dependencies can they exploit that will give them the most bang for their buck. So that when they go after a particular software package that maybe gets 500,000 downloads per week, then that is guaranteed to impact maybe 10,000 companies across 200 countries. Then they are doing easy work to get the most maximum impact. And that is only going to increase and escalate in complexity. And to borrow some scientific terms, there's this thing called entropy, and how it's basically entropy always increases. A chaotic system will tend to become chaotic. A tidy house, if left on its own, will become untidy. So the cybercrime ecosystem, as much as defenders are trying to defend, it's just the nature of the system to become more chaotic with time. So that's kind of my take on the things we see now and where it could end up getting to.
So let me ask you. So yeah, it's interesting. I was just reading an interesting article on entropy and size and complexity, and that complexity breeds entropy and vice versa. And it was just an interesting take on it. It was more from a physics perspective, but it really, you know, to your point, it has definitely has a dynamic here. But let me challenge that for a moment. Let me put you on the spot and challenge that. There's a level of entropy, there's a level of complexity, and it gets harder and harder. And you were saying that the adversaries are having sleepless nights too, because they're trying to figure out new ways to do it. I'm gonna counter that a little bit. And yes, they're going to have interesting nights. I'm not going to say that their nights are sleepless and trying to figure out new ways, because I mean, if you just look at the recent education issues and the ransomware, you know, elements that have just hit in the last week, I think they're still having a lot of low hanging fruit and a lot of low hanging targets that are monetarily viable. So I guess my question is that we still have, notwithstanding the fortune, and I'm going to go really broad here and say the Fortune 500, right? And you and I both know that out of the Fortune 500, there are probably a good 30, 40, 50, 60% that are not up to standards to protect themselves. And we got to this point because financially, it's hard to do. Hmm. What do you do after Fortune 501 on down, right? So now you're talking about targets, and I'm not going to necessarily say that they're not doing the right thing, because I think they're – I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to be Pollyanna for a moment and be very upbeat and say, let's say 98% of the people are trying to do the right thing. They don't necessarily have the money to do it, but if you've got $6.7 trillion in the potential bucket for our adversaries, you do a whole lot more damage, and that damage can expand and grow. I mean, even if you talk about a 10% increase annually – and you think about the numbers that you're talking about there, you're talking about almost $700 billion. Hmm. That's a tremendous amount. So I guess the real question remains is that, are they really getting sleepless nights, or are they working better together than they ever have? You know, and bring in, let's bring in Russia for a moment. You know, Russia attacked Ukraine. What happened? What happened with Anonymous? What happened with many other areas? And by the way, that same APT may now have a fourth, you know, division and fourth target on Sunday night that they didn't have before. Now they're pivoting because they're getting paid for this other. You know, what are your thoughts there? Where do you see that going?
Right, right. So when you rephrased your argument just now, it got me thinking about what we all know as initial access brokers. You probably know where I'm going with this, so I'll just break it down further. So threat actors are always looking for the most efficient way to do whatever it is they want to do. Financial targets, espionage, hacktivism, and so on. So now we have a threat actor or a group of actors. Maybe they're commanded by someone in uniform. Maybe not. Maybe it's all private, offensive threat actors or whatever. Now they are trying to figure out, do we really want to commit 3, 4, 5 days into gaining access into a particular network? Or we can just find someone on the dark web who specializes in gaining access to networks. We pay them some commission, or we bring them on as a contractor, and then all they have to figure out for us is access into networks. We would figure out the exploit development. We would figure out the penetration, exfiltration, and so on and so forth, lateral movement, persistence, etc. All we want you to do for us as our contractor. I've even seen cases where they actually have HR type agreements, employment agreements saying, your job is to provide us access. Let us worry about the rest. Let us worry about the legal stuff. If we ever get caught, we're not going to mention your name and so on. So now, threat actors are not necessarily getting sleepless nights because they've basically figured out a way to divide their labor and get themselves more efficient. If I can get an initial access broker that would get me access, I would cut down my operational timeline by as much as 7, 8, 10 days. So that way, I'm not getting into a network and making a whole lot of noise because someone is giving me credentials and session cookies and browser fingerprints and so on. And I'm getting in as if I'm an employee of that organization. So however the initial access broker got that, I really don't care. I don't want to know. That's on them to figure out their own operational security. Then I, as the main guy, would also figure out my own operational security. So now it's interesting because we see hacks happening now that are less noisy than as recently as a year or 2 years ago, simply because of this reason, or at least in my opinion.
It's interesting. So let me ask you, now I'm going to pivot on that. So let me pivot for a little bit, because we hear about that end and you talk about the ease, but now let's talk about a couple of the interesting newsworthy items, you know, that and how they correspond, and talk to me a little bit about how they marry up. So let's talk about Patreon firing their entire security staff. I mean, we're talking about a platform that funnels through what, $3-4 billion, yeah, to their users or through their user chain. They just got rid of their entire security staff. We talk about the Twitter whistleblower, and you know what he says is, you know, from what I've seen. So I'm gonna get on my own soapbox here. he mentions things that happen in a lot of companies, and we know that. I think the real key is, was it intentional? Was it egregious? Was it something that what knowingly was malicious in intent to not do? But as we look at that, and we look at just those two examples, in today's day and age, I think the question is are we, you know, you talked about entropy before, but are we regressing in some respects, or is this a different challenge that's now coming out and about because organizations are now trying to pivot and shift differently. You know, take the Patreon one. I don't know why they did it. Maybe they're outsourcing everything. It could be for the better. Maybe they hired, and I won't name company names, but maybe they outsourced it and they thought that they could do better than with the 5, 10, 15 people that they might have had on staff. What are your thoughts on that in response to the economic growth that we're seeing on the adversary side?
I think a lot of companies are about to literally shoot themselves in the foot. And I can actually argue both sides. So, but I'm going to stick with the shoot themselves in the foot angle. So if Patreon, for example, they're actually a well-known company, in the people that try to set up gigs and entrepreneurs and so on, and they get their fans to donate and contribute, blah, blah, blah. And for whatever reason, which, like you mentioned, no one knows why, they're getting rid of their entire security department. And the people they're getting rid of are going online to publicly say negative things about Patreon. Maybe that's, those are lawsuits waiting to happen. Maybe not, who knows. But it can't be good from an internal point of view. And only the people in Patreon knows why this is happening. Anyway, on the other hand, Twitter, as big as Twitter is, Mudge is basically saying Twitter doesn't necessarily know the extent to which its security lapses are bad. And the leadership is telling the board of directors one thing and telling the shareholder something else. And it's just a catastrophic scenario at Twitter right now. And nobody and their cousins want to work for Twitter. However, adversaries are actually paying attention to all these things happening as well. So maybe Patreon knows something we don't know, and I want to believe the leadership is thinking about how adversaries are reading all of these tea leaves and maybe waiting to come after them, or maybe they have defenses in place. Who knows? Twitter as well. Prior to this drama going on with Twitter, I've been following how bots are being run on Twitter for intel collection. And the Saudis are actually going front and center, planting insiders in Twitter to get information about dissidents and journalists that use Twitter to malign the Saudi kingdom. So that has been happening from as far back as 2015, 2016. I think recently two Saudis were indicted regarding how they were using Twitter for spying on journalists. So maybe that is actually included in the Senate hearing that happened recently. Maybe not. I don't know. I only know what I read online from open sources and some not so open sources as well. The point now is companies, like I said, some of them are about to get themselves shot in the foot, because if you are thinking of saving costs or farming out some security operations to some part of the world where it's cheaper for you, that's good from a business perspective. But then, like I said earlier, there is no one way to approach security. Think about your physical security. Now think about your cybersecurity on an enterprise level. There can't be one way to look at it. It's one thing to drive on the highway and keep to the speed limit, but then I'm making sure I have a 360-degree view of the car in front of me, the two cars beside me, the one behind me, the two in my blind spot, my own state of mind, whether I'm arguing with my wife or not, whether I'm hungry and maybe I'm driving and I'm angry. All of these things encompass my physical security on the highway. It's not just, is my car in good condition? So using that analogy, you cannot just depend on your security teams being in good condition and then you saving money for your organization. You have to think about your industry, what your rivals are doing, what threat actors are doing, what threat actors are doing to your vendors and your clients, and on and on and on. So that's how I think about these things. And yeah.
So you took that and you went all the way down into the sort of this rabbit hole, which I appreciate, because you brought up a lot of really good points, which is what you really addressed in my mind as you went through that is you addressed two significant problems. One is the sheer size and complexity of the ecosystem that we're dealing with, not necessarily just one company, but the interaction between the whole ecosystem and the fact that they're interconnected. But the other thing that you brought up, and maybe it was direct, maybe it was tangential, but you brought up the business construct of it and the implications of business decisions, not security decisions, business decisions, because as we've talked about before, at the end of the day, there's this interesting disconnect, and it's getting smaller, but there's a disconnect between the cybersecurity mindset and what has to be done and what should be done and what must be done. You know, the whole, no, it's not secure, you can't do that, versus the business mindset, which is, what? We're here to make money. You know, even a nonprofit is there to make something, right? And not necessarily a profit, but there are, you know, the benefits to its constituency, whatever that might be. And the two haven't intersected yet. And really, you kind of hit on that, the fact that you're only hearing the sides that are publicly announced, and there are so many more nuances to it. So that's an interesting take. I'm gonna go back to something that you talked about earlier, and I'd like your take on this. So kind of progressing through this. You were talking about data earlier, you were talking about the complexity, you were talking about the aggregation of data, and you also, and I'm going to paraphrase because I'm going to use the term, you know, spray and pray, right? As you get the large, you know, it's like a shotgun effect where, you know, you're hoping to hit, you've got a million pellets and you're hoping to hit, you know, some that are going to be profitable. Where do you think with the decentralization, we talked about this before, the expansion, the contraction, where do you think the decentralization, so the DeFi components, the DAO components, the interesting dynamic of how blockchain's being used, self-sovereign identities, you know, the Web3 overlaying contract, where do you think that's going to both be a help and a detractor for cybersecurity professionals?
Okay, so based on conversations we've had previously about how the Web3 and blockchain technologies and DeFi and DAO and all of those things, we've talked about how they're trying to situate themselves within this modern day cybersecurity industry, within, I would even zoom out and say within globalization itself, as something that is basically an evolution of the human history, basically. So all of these things, and then thinking about their security ramifications and considerations, both the ones people are thinking about and the ones people are not thinking about, how would all of this impact security from an enterprise perspective, from an individual perspective, from just security as a practice, as something that people do, people account for, people budget for, people make New Year speeches for, people literally go to a VC, venture capitalist, and actually make a slide deck that addresses the security of a potential startup. So all of this, I would say, would create more complexity, also known as more entropy, more chaos, if I can use that word, because now we have to account for things that we cannot necessarily control. A good example was when the hypothetical scenario I mentioned on your episode 178, saying, if I live in Tampa, Florida, and I want to say that as a resident of Tampa, Florida, I pay taxes to Hillsborough County, I should have a say on where my data shows up for advertising. Asterisk, the data that the city of Tampa collects about me, meaning the license plate of my car, anywhere I drive within the city of Tampa, my face on any intersection when I'm walking or I'm going to the gym or wherever I'm going to, basically anything that has to do with me, with anytime I pay my water bill or my phone bill or anything whatsoever, any sales tax and so on, I should be able to have a say on where that data shows up. If that is agreed on a smart contract, then if a mom and pop shop opens up in the plaza next to my where I live, now they are bound by this smart contract. They don't know me, but they have to abide by the rules that I have agreed to with the city of Tampa. So what happens when I show up to that coffee shop and I want to buy coffee? They cannot capture my data as their potential customer because there's a smart contract in place with the city of Tampa, which they are bound to honor. So now are we saying the coffee shop is not going to have a customer database simply because there's a smart contract that is bound to honor my privacy as a citizen of Tampa, Florida? So now we are just introducing unnecessary complexities. Businesses exist to make profits. They want to provide good service to their customers, but they cannot do that if they don't know their customers. They don't know their customers because there's a smart contract preventing them, literally preventing them from knowing their customers. So how do we get around that? And that's just one element for one coffee shop, for one smart contract, for one city in the United States. These are things that literally keep me up at night.
So it's an interesting prospect, and you brought this up, you're right, on episode 178, we talked about it. And I'm still going to be pessimistic and say that we are a very, 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 very long way away from any municipality having the wherewithal to be able to tie all that together and know who you are, to legally be bound to a privacy component to that. I think we are still a ways away. But you bring up a point about, I think, what is the business conundrum, right? Which is businesses, people have become used to, and people have sold their souls in many instances to get freebies or information or whatever it is from companies. And that dynamic with Web3 is going to change a little bit. And now we have to look at how do we secure that? So now let's pivot a little bit. You talked about the complexities of how it might impact the small coffee shop. But let's talk for a moment about a lot of your listeners and the security professionals that are listening. What do you think they need to be? And this is going to circle back to the education piece and the self-learning component and the self-improvement. With the new technologies and with the new paradigms that are showing up, what is your prediction on where security professionals need to start looking at and maybe ramping up their skills and improving? What are some of those specialty areas? Because as we know, there are many specialty areas within cybersecurity. What are the ones that you think really become that next influx?
So I would say the first thing I would pay attention to would be securing data at rest and in transit. So a good example is financial institutions. That's a good example of how data at rest merges with data in transit almost daily. One example I like to use is my own bank account. Sometimes I do stuff on my account. Sometimes a week goes by and nobody's taking bill charges. I'm not swiping my card because I'm trying to respect myself. And all of that shows my data at rest, but it can change within 1 second. Mm-hmm. I can decide to send money to my wife or my brother or anybody else. And now you have a transaction that wasn't planned that has to go through, because otherwise I would be calling Bank of America customer care. All of that is, like I said, a good example of an industry where data at rest and data in transit need to be secure 24/7. On the other hand of that is the same financial industry, tax season. Some people don't touch their tax software until April 14, literally a day before the deadline. Then you see a whole lot of activity on, and then April 16 up until April 14 the next year, zero activity. So in that case, how would I want to pay attention to securing data at rest, data in transit on a Web3 platform, on a financial industry that is now backed by blockchain, and I have to make sure that everybody conducting transactions, maybe on Black Friday, is who they say they are. And everyone buying gifts for their grandma and their grandpa and their uncles and aunties on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve, every single one of them are who they say they are, and they are not trying to use someone else's card to pay for something for someone else across the world or across the country. Or if I say I want to buy a house, I saved up enough, and myself and my partner, we are good to go. And we show up at the realtor, we look at a few houses, we make a down payment, we do all the escrow documents and so on. And now the title company is about to verify our identity, but something goes wrong. We know we are who we say we are, but then they don't believe us. And then the old emotional toll that goes with that, maybe it takes a month to fix or 6 months. And we thought we were about to buy the house of our dreams, but that is not going to happen because something somewhere within the blockchain messed up. We know who we say we are, but the title company doesn't believe us. Unless, of course, it's my uncle that owns the title company, then he can say we are good for it. But how many people have their uncles running title companies? So now we're talking about self-sovereign identities, both for the banking transactions and escrow transactions and tax season and so on. That is going to cause a whole lot of headache because even just the system breaking, and we're not even talking about threat actors doing stuff to the system. The system can glitch every now and then. Maybe an update messed something up for a batch of users and they couldn't do their transactions. Or a threat actor was able to get into the blockchain and tamper with one or two things. Now it's just introducing, like I said, unnecessary complexities, just like the example of the coffee shop that cannot have a database of its customers.
First off, I agree with you. As you were talking about something, I wanted to pull up some data. I knew some of it off the top of my head, but some of this is really interesting. And I'm going to throw some interesting stats out there because I think, you know, you're talking about data at rest, data in transit, and I think, I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. My personal opinion is that as we progress more into Web3 and the protocols behind blockchain, et cetera, you know, riding, and we talked about this before, we are riding on these older protocols, you know, whether it's, you know, TCP, UDP, et cetera. The fact is that we're now putting another layer of security, encryption, decentralization, you know, to help with this. So let me give you a couple of interesting stats. And it's funny, I had an interesting conversation with somebody several months back about SSL and TLS. So I wanted to bring some of these up because I thought it was interesting. So as you are probably very well aware, but as some of your listeners may not be, SSL was deprecated several years ago. I mean, if anybody is you know, remembers Poodle and the impact. Right. TLS, by the way, so PCI, so the payment card industry, their Security Standards Council, so the PCI SSC, stated that, and I'm going to give a date here because we're now, as you mentioned earlier, we're in September of 2022 at the moment. Back in June, they had stated to site owners that they wanted TLS 1.0. Now, mind you, if you think about the progression, SSL came out before and was deprecated. TLS 1.0 was out in parallel. 1.1, they said to disable TLS 1.0 June of 2018. So well over 4 years ago. So now, if we're talking that SSL was to be deprecated well before that, right now, there are just shy of 176 million sites on the internet using SSL certificates. Okay.
Wow.
So let's move a little bit further, right? And, you know, let's go back. 6.8% of the top 100,000 sites. So we're talking, you know, 6,800 are still supporting SSL 2.0. So it's even older. Wow. Now, let's jump back a little bit more and talk about, you know, let's look at some of the impact where we start talking about mobile devices. And what they're finding is that 35%, or roughly a little bit more, of unencrypted user traffic to Google, and that's just Google, is from mobile devices. People thinking that, oh, this is going to be more secure because I'm not plugged into something. So it's interesting when you start talking about data at rest and data in transit, because 68% of websites still support TLS 1.0. 68%. Now, wow. I'm going to ask you a trick question. Which countries, and I'll let you, there are three that are tied. I will let you pick two of the three. Who are the top countries in the percentage of encryption? I'm gonna kill the suspense here as well and say it's not the US.
Huh. China, Russia, India.
All right, so India, yep.
Huh. So is it correlated with population?
No, actually it doesn't. So I am scanning through to find some of the specific numbers at the moment, but I will tell you that that it was India topped off. And if you think about volumes there, so 90% of all traffic to Google in India is encrypted. And they are tied in first place with the UK and Japan.
Wow.
So kudos to them.
Wow.
And then the next group of countries at 95% is Indonesia, Mexico, and Brazil. Now think about this for a moment. So they're followed by France at 92%. And then you get to the Russia and US at 91%. Wow. And by the way, we're saying 91%, but now you have to think, okay, so it's encrypted, but it's using SSL. Right, SSL 2.0, right. 3.0, TLS 1.0.
Wow.
So even though it's encrypted, it's using deprecated protocols.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
I thought you might like some of that as we were talking. It got me thinking about that. So look, we are, you know, we've been talking now for over an hour. And what I find interesting is this, and I'd like for you to take the next piece of this. What I find interesting is that cybersecurity was not something that you intended on going into. As a matter of fact, you had already finished your bachelor's, you were working on your graduate programs, you'd been to Ghana, you then you came to the US, and you took this parallel but somewhat divergent path of what you were doing because of the interest there. Do you regret your decision at all? And for people who are listening, especially those who are trying to grow in their careers as well, what would you recommend? What would you say would be helpful to them that you've learned?
I thank you so much once again for this question. I've asked 40 something people this same question, and I've actually never asked myself what I would tell someone who wants to take a similar route or take the same route or whatever. And even when you ask about, do I regret anything? I want to say now, that's not an easy question to answer. I can say, okay, I don't regret anything because of the way my career has turned out. However, I am the one that knows every step of the way up until this point, today, September 13, 2022. Looking back to even deciding to study electrical engineering and all the decisions that went into that and all the passes and failures while in undergrad, master's, PhD, and so on, And even getting into the industry, working for all the companies I've worked for, I would say there are points in time where I questioned my decision to take this route. I could have stopped at bachelor's. I could have stayed in academia. I could have gotten into corporate America and just focused on that security operation center type work. Even when I transitioned into threat intelligence and intelligence analysis, I could have just narrowed my focus and not dabble in geopolitical intelligence and all this fun stuff I do now. And even with every job, and this is something you have probably, this is something you are very familiar with, the imposter syndrome, when you question yourself saying, these people are about to figure out I don't know anything. They're going to fire me. I'm going to get found out. And that is a real feeling. I don't care how old you are. I don't care how many years you've been in whatever industry you are. It happens to everybody, which makes me question, why did I choose this path? Because I'm quite good at reading maps. I could have easily gotten something with geospatial intelligence or something geography related. I'm quite good at figuring out pattern analysis. I'm quite good at picking up new languages. I could have done so many different types of careers. Even now, I'm learning that I'm good at interviewing people. I could have gone into radio. But everything happens for a reason. Like I said, it's not an easy question to answer. But of course, like most things in life, it's good when we have introspective episodes. Sometimes I'm on a walk, or I'm in a boxing gym, or I'm playing basketball, and I'm just thinking, so what's next? So I'm getting all the skills. I'm talking to everybody on my podcast and sharing the knowledge I have. And I'm thinking, it's quite possible I don't end up at age 65, 70 as a cybersecurity intelligence analyst. Still a lot of time. It's quite possible this podcasting thing is what takes me to that next step. It's quite possible it's basketball coaching or boxing. Or So long story short, it's not an easy question to answer. There are points in time where I question my decision to be in cybersecurity. And again, it's sometimes yes, some regret, sometimes no regret, sometimes in between.
So it depends on the day. I got you. Depends on the issue du jour.
Right, sir.
makes perfect sense. So what advice would you give to people who are either coming up through the ranks in cybersecurity or that are thinking about getting into cybersecurity?
Right. So based on the podcast episodes, sometimes I get questions from people who know the guest I interviewed. Sometimes I get questions from just people I don't know who listen to the podcast. I've had a few people that found me on Spotify because they searched for a different cybersecurity podcast and they found mine and they were like, oh, let me check this out. Sometimes it's just a friend of a friend. And I've been fortunate enough to actually have a few people who are in constant communication with me at different stages of getting into cybersecurity. There's a friend in Dallas. She was able to get a Security Plus, and now she works for some company out there. There are two or three people who are trying to get their Security Plus certifications and so on. They are actually in the process of studying for the exam. There are folks from Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, Dubai, in the US, of course. At different stages of transitioning, I have someone who went to nursing school. She realized she doesn't like it. Now she wants to get into IT program management. So I would say, do things that you are interested in. Do things that you're passionate about, because that would be the differentiator when those days come, and they are definitely going to come. Those days where you start doubting yourself, when you start questioning your decisions. If it's something you're not passionate about, you would be quick to drop it. If it's something you are passionate about, that passion would overrule those doubts. It's like lawyers and judges. Some lawyers say objection, the judge either says sustained or overruled. So your doubt is saying objection, but your passion is saying overruled. If your passion is not strong enough, it's going to be sustained.
So I agree with you. I'm going to throw a counterpoint. And as my kids were heading off to college, my older ones were heading off to college, I heard an interesting NPR broadcast that because I was always, yeah, do what you're passionate about. And this woman changed my perspective a bit, not 100%, but a good bit. She was a CFO for Fortune 500, and I can't remember her name. I can't remember the company. It's been a very long time. And one of the things she was talking about, she said, look, I'm really, really good at finance. Is it my passion? No, it's not. My passion's photography. She said, but I realized that photography doesn't pay very well. And nor did I want to take pictures for other people. I wanted to take them for myself. So I found something that I was good at. I found something that I wasn't necessarily passionate about, but I enjoy. I enjoy the people I work with. But it enables me. I am now at a position and a level to where I could take pictures wherever I want. I could buy any of the gear that I want because I'm doing extraordinarily well in something that I'm good at. Maybe not passionate about. And I thought it was an interesting take and an interesting dynamic on that balancing act between being able to do something that you are passionate about versus something that you're good at versus something that's going to pay the bills. Because you could be a very passionate photographer and not have enough money to pay your rent every month versus being a CFO at a Fortune 500 and being able to travel the world and take pictures anywhere you want. So I thought that was an interesting take. And for me personally, the reason why I said it mostly changed my opinion is I think you have to do more than like what you're doing. I think there has to be a level and be good at it. I think there, you're right. There has to be this level of passion, but maybe it's not your top passion. Maybe it's something that you can get passionate about 2 days a week. Maybe not all five. Maybe not 100% of the time. What do you think about that? What are your thoughts on that?
I actually never thought about it this way. And as you're describing it, I'm actually thinking about what I'm doing. So, of course, I enjoy. Cybersecurity, threat intelligence. I literally left academia to get situated in cybersecurity. And now I'm realizing that as I'm going ahead, as I'm going further in life generally, we need skills that we don't necessarily have previously. Think about it this way. I have a 3-year-old. Before, he couldn't sit up by himself. So he learned how to sit up and then he crawled. From crawling, he started walking, and now he runs and I can't even catch up with him. That is true. So at every point in time along that timeline, he developed skills that he didn't have before so that he can get to the next phase. So from sitting up, he learned how to crawl so that he can walk. So in the same vein, academia taught me so many things that I took into cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is teaching me so many things that I'm bringing into podcasting. Podcasting is teaching me so many things that I will take into that next thing, which I don't know yet. So passion and things I enjoy doing, things that would pay the bills. Yes, I agree. There are things that we have to do, but we don't necessarily want to do for someone else, or we don't necessarily want to do because it's not paying the bills. So for me, I would say the ability to talk to people is something I'm realizing I'm good at. I wouldn't say I, of course, I don't feel like talking to people all the time. People think I'm an extrovert. I am not an extrovert. I'm actually an introvert. But then when I'm talking to folks like yourself and I'm on the podcast interviewing people, I come across as an extrovert. I am really not. So I wouldn't necessarily want to talk to people 5 days a week. No. But when it comes to research and investigations and analysis and intel analysis and so on, you've seen some of my products back at Verizon. Mm-hmm. I would do that for 10 hours straight in this chair. Maybe not 40 hours a week necessarily, maybe 35, give or take. And then the remaining 5 I spend on producing my podcast. And then I balance it out here and there. So I agree with what you said. I never really thought about it that way. I have friends who like photography. They wouldn't necessarily want to take pictures for anybody. But then you hear them complaining about their job that pays the bills. So,
yeah. Good point. So, Ben, I will tell you, I learn something new each and every time we talk, and I am appreciative of it. I am really appreciative of it. I want to remind your listeners at this point that not only did we just do a 180 and a retrospective and view on and a look back on BID, but I think we found that the new title of this particular podcast may need to just be Renaissance Man.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much, sir. I really appreciate that.
No, and I appreciate the honor of letting me do this.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I consider you someone who has so much wisdom, and I cannot even begin to imagine how you got to acquire so much. And I would say it's one thing to spend so long in doing something, but not everybody learns from the experience. They think it's something, okay, you gain experience, but then does experience then feed into you? Or do you just gain experience? It's like a cyclical thing that has to happen.
So I first off, I appreciate that. I wouldn't call it wisdom, and I would tell you that my wife and kids would certainly argue that point and definitely call it wisdom. I think they would call it being old. I think my wife would also say that I am a perpetual 13-year-old, okay? And she's not wrong in some respects, right? And what I mean by that is that so yes, I am opinionated. Yes, I'm old. But I love learning. I am not, and I'm going to be the first one to admit it, I did not do well in academia. Hmm. I didn't. I'm always impressed by people who can and who do. I learn through experiential, right? And through talking with other people and learning that way. And I absorb it and I enjoy it. And it's one of, you know, you find that you have a few innate skills and you find that you're really, really bad at a whole lot more than you're good at. And shit, I've discovered that many, many times. But I love looking back and learning and taking it. And how do you do the next, you know, to your point, what's the next thing? Hell, my new business isn't even in this business. And I'm not going to divulge all that now, but yeah, but it's to your point. You might next wind up being a basketball coach. And I love that. And that's the whole point that I was talking about, you know, by renaming this Renaissance Man, because I think your outlook, your perspective, and your desire to just continue growing and learning and just do it is tremendous. It's phenomenal. So,
thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure talking to you once again.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Talk to you later.
Take care. Bye.
Big Picture Podcast is produced by Sunshine Media in association with Alowinle Productions. Fact-checking by Zara Kuznetsova. Audio engineer, Sergey Gorsky. Graphic design, Stacey Graham. Senior producer, Bidemi Ologunde. Executive producers, Olufolani Ologunde and Tobiloba Ologunde. Please join me again on the next episode as I continue with a deep dive on cybersecurity's news, events, and incidents, and the lessons we can learn from them for robust cyber threat intelligence and awareness in our daily lives. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the Big Picture Podcast. on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, Pandora, TuneIn Radio, or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Also, please share the show with anyone that you think might benefit from it. For questions, comments, or any suggestions, please send an email to bidme@thebidpicture.com. You can also get in touch on Twitter @BidPicture, on the Clubhouse app @Bid, as well as on the Wisdom app @BidME. Please remember to leave a review for the podcast if your platform allows you to do so. Thank you for your time. See you on the next episode. Bye for now.